From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. In a moment, we'll be talking with two authors, one of them a Homeland Security officer, former See Something, Say Nothing, an amazing story. Wait till you hear it. Later on tonight, The Treasure of the Mind. Here's what's happening. Well, check your cupboards. Hostess Brands issuing a voluntary recall of 710,000 cases of select snack cakes and donuts over possible undeclared peanut residue in flour. Among the products included, the recall are Ding Dongs, chocolate donuts, Zingers, and others. Just beware, especially if you have a peanut allergy. A prosecutor said that he is not going to seek charges against the mother of a three-year-old boy who got into that Cincinnati Zoo's gorilla exhibit, resulting in the shooting of that endangered gorilla to protect him. Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters said the child's mother had three other children with her, and she was attending to all of them when the three-year-old just scampered off on May 28th. No charges there. Scientists in the United States are trying to grow human organs inside of pigs. They have injected human stem cells into the pig embryos to produce human pig embryos known as chimeras. The embryos are part of research aimed at overcoming the worldwide shortage of transplant organs. That's an amazing story. Hillary Clinton has apparently clinched the Democratic presidential nomination, according to CNN's delegate and superdelegate count, and will become the first woman in the 240-year history of the United States to lead the presidential ticket of a major political party. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, that kind of takes the sales out of tomorrow, doesn't it, John?
Well, not really, because, you know, while the networks start, you know, declaring the presumptive nominee, the reality is that those delegates, those superdelegates, 571 of them that Hillary has, cannot be awarded until the convention starts. That is the only time those delegates can be counted. So really, tomorrow, she's got 1,812 delegates, and she may be able to get to that magic number of 2383, but actually it's pretty doubtful, because it looks very much like Bernie is going to split the delegates with her, whatever state she's in. So it's not, it is possible tomorrow. There's still, I mean, I think they're really jumping the gun right now. While it's true she has those superdelegates in her pocket, and a lot of people think it's a pretty dirty, I mean, not just Trump, but I mean, Sanders certainly thinks it's a pretty rigged election. I mean, that somehow that, you know, the voters, primary voters, don't really count as much as some party bosses and other people who have, you know, been issued these delegate counts. So, you know, so when you add them up, George, she's got 1,812 right now. There's about 700 or so at stake tomorrow. She may wind up getting, you know, 300 of those, but she may not get to that number of 2383 tomorrow, even though most people are counting the superdelegates, putting her over the top.
You think CNN might end up with a little egg on their face?
Well, I think it's not just CNN. I mean, the AP was the one that announced it first, and then they just went ahead and rubber stamped what AP said. But it's not the earned delegates. It's with those 571 superdelegates.
Yeah, that's important.
And they cannot be officially awarded to Hillary until the convention. That's when those superdelegates cast their vote, not before. But the thing is that Bernie has closed, which is remarkable. He was like 30 points behind her like a month ago.
I know.
He is now closed within 2% right now, within the statistical margin of error. It is very probable with a good turnout in California tomorrow.
All right, we're going to talk to you tomorrow night, okay?
All right.
Thanks. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. A serial killer known as the Grim Sleeper should be sentenced to death for murdering 9 women and a teenage girl over more than 2 decades in South Los Angeles, according to a jury. Lonnie Franklin, he's 63 years old. He's a former city trash collector and garage attendant for the L.A. Police Department, was convicted of 10 counts of first-degree murder last month for crimes dating back more than 30 years. Unbelievable. A Michigan man's wife is now the suspect in a May 2015 murder Newly obtained police reports show that a winged witness may have heard the man's final plea. Now, you're not going to believe this. An African gray parrot might have overheard Martin Durham as he pleaded with the shooter before the killer pumped 5 bullets into his body. The bird, his name is Bud, was heard saying, "Don't blankety blank, I can't repeat it, shoot," in a video taken shortly after Durham's death. The bird picks up everything and anything and has the filthiest mouth around, according to the mother of the dead man. Wow. People are spending less time on social media apps and in some cases substantially less. A new study from a marketing intelligence firm, SimilarWeb, has found out. Facebook's Instagram saw the biggest year-over-year drop, usage down almost 24%, Twitter 23%, Snapchat down 15%, Facebook down 8%. And hackers have targeted Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's social media accounts, briefly hijacking his LinkedIn and Twitter accounts as well. Let's check in with the expert, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It looks like the Zuckerberg hack has two culprits that were involved. First, there's LinkedIn itself. You may not remember this. We may have even talked about it sometime over the years here. But 4 years ago, there was a password hack at LinkedIn where about 6.5 million passwords
were
compromised. Well, it turns out that we've just recently learned it was actually more like 117 million passwords, a significant difference.
Yeah.
And this was because LinkedIn was sloppy. They used a very weak hashing algorithm on their passwords. That's how you're supposed to keep the passwords from being in the clear. So if someone steals them, they're not easily crackable. Well, the way LinkedIn did it, they were still easily crackable. And that brings us to culprit number two. It appears, and this is this isn't 100% known, but this is good speculation based on the evidence we have, that Zuckerberg was sharing passwords between these services. In other words, it looks like when his LinkedIn password was compromised, because he was using the same password for other services, something we have often discussed,
yes,
you should never do,
and warned against
many times, that caused his other accounts to be compromised because he was using the same password for Twitter and for other things. Now, some of those accounts were defaced for a brief time. Those have been cleaned up now. Presumably, he's updated his passwords. But really, there's a lesson here. Don't share the passwords. One, have good, strong passwords. Two, don't share your passwords between services. And three, if you have two-step authentication available where it sends you a code by text message or through an authentication app or through a security key, anything that adds a second factor, avail yourself of it. Use it. Because otherwise, you're just, easy prey for hackers out there.
All right, and quick reaction. Why are these app usages down?
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of burnout occurring now because, to a certain extent, they're very similar, right? We have different apps from different competing services that are providing very similar functionality. And as people try different ones, they tend to migrate to one and then the other, and they say it's a new feature, so they pop over there. And eventually people start to burn out on it. Also, they migrate into other things. So, for example, people started with text messaging, then they moved to audio messaging, then they moved to video messaging. I think the bottom line, though, is that the big players in this are still the big players, right? I mean, there's a certain amount of it's like shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic sometimes, the old saying. But this is a Titanic that isn't going to sink. It's just going to change shape. It's going to evolve. But when you look at it at any given moment in time, it just seems like an ever-changing flux of services.
All right, my friend. Thanks, Lauren. I always appreciate your workforce. Get ready for this. U.S. officials appear poised to make history by approving the first private space mission to go beyond Earth's orbit. The government's endorsement would eliminate the largest regulatory hurdle by plans of a company called Moon Express, which is a relatively obscure space startup, to land a roughly 20-pound package of scientific hardware on the moon sometime next year. So here we go. Up next, see something, say nothing. This is an incredible story, and we'll have it next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Two patriots for guests for the first couple hours tonight. Both co-authors of the book, See Something, Say Nothing. We'll explain that title in a moment. First, Art Moore. He's the editor for the online news giant, WND.com. He entered the media world as a public relations assistant for the Seattle Mariners. That's the baseball team. And a sports correspondent for the Associated Press Radio. He served for 10 years in Eastern Europe with a Christian organization, earning a master's degree in communications from the Wheaton College before joining WND shortly after 9/11. He was an editor for the news service Worldwide Newsroom and senior news writer for the Christianity Today magazine, Art Moore on Coast to Coast. Art, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, George.
Looking forward to this. And, of course, let me introduce Philip Haney. Studied Arabic culture and language while working as a scientist in the Middle East before he was hired as a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security back in 2003. Becoming an Armed Customs and Border Protection officer, he served several tours of duty at the National Targeting Center near Washington, D.C., where he was quickly promoted to its advanced targeting team. He has specialized in Islamic theology and the strategy and tactics of the global Islamic movement. Philip Haney on Coast to Coast. Philip, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
In my broken Arabic, I would say marhaba to you, but I hope it makes sense. But it's good to have you both with us. And Art, let us start with you. If you can give us a little background of your relationship with Philip and the work behind See Something, Say Nothing.
Sure, sure. Well, it was about 6 years ago, and a mutual contact of ours in the counterterrorism field, his name is Jeff Epstein, got us together on a three-way call. And at that time, I didn't even know Philip's name. I didn't know exactly where he worked. All I knew was that he was a DHS agent. He was on the inside. And I began to listen to him talk about his view of the world and what was going on from the inside. And I began to realize, we've got somebody on the inside who gets it. This is somebody who, unlike the administration he worked for, understands the threat. And that's really where the conflict lies right there, is there's two conflicting narratives. There's one that says groups such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda are simply a bunch of malcontents or a bunch of haters who hate because they hate. And then there's another narrative that says that while respecting religious plurality, we recognize that the people who are threatening Western civilization base their actions on a historic interpretation of sacred texts. And it may not be the interpretation of all who identify as Muslim, but it is the interpretation of a sizable portion. And I began to hear him talk about the fact that because of that conflict, he couldn't do his job. He was trying to apply basic law enforcement principles, but those principles were being subjected to what was being described as the civil rights and civil liberties of people who threaten our nation's security. And so last year, I discovered he was retiring at the end of July. And so we met just days after he retired, and that's when the book began to take shape.
Okay. And Philip, let me bring you in. Was this a retirement? Was this planned by you, or did they kind of force you out?
No, I was eligible to retire by my age 62, and in all honesty, I probably would still be working if the circumstances were different. And I'm actually thankful that I was able to retire. So I retired honorably, and it was based on my age. So for that, I'm thankful.
Okay, and the title, of course, See Something, Say Nothing, is a takeoff on what the former administrations wanted everyone to do after 9/11, and that was see something, say something. So something, Art, has obviously happened with the change of the title for your book, See Something, Say Nothing. Give us a highlight here. What the heck has happened?
Well, the book is really what Philip saw over the course of nearly 14 years, and we highlight a number of amazing events. And I think what was remarkable to me when I began to hear his story was that if you wanted to do a chronology of the seminal events in the history of DHS, which is not a long history. It goes back to just shortly after 9/11. It was created because of 9/11.
Yes, it was.
If you wanted to highlight the really critical events of the DHS history, you could do it through Philip's story. He was right there. He witnessed it. He I'll just to begin real briefly. He witnessed memos that began to come across his desk that were clearly originated from Muslim Brotherhood front groups that were essentially dictating to our government leaders how they should train officers, how they should speak to the public, the way they should describe the threat.
And I want to make sure, too, that everybody listening understands that we are not attacking Muslims who are God-loving, good, dedicated people, a lot of them in this country. We are talking about jihadist folks. We are talking about radicals who want to extinguish our way of life. So, Philip, tell us when you started seeing something wrong here in River City. What did you start seeing that got you to believe that we weren't doing the right job?
Well, the first harbinger for me was in the year 2006. I wrote an article on the web called Green Tide Rising, Hamas Ascends. It was a straightforward analysis, past, present, and future, right after the elections there in the West Bank and in Gaza, where they elected Hamas to be the government of the people in Gaza. So naturally, being a counterterrorism specialist and with a subject matter expertise in these type of groups, I wrote an analysis. Well, I shared this analysis, the same one that was posted on the web, with some contract teachers from the Central Intelligence Agency who were teaching us how to interview individuals and be able to tell whether they were lying to us or not. I shared the story with them. I mean, I handed them copies of it, thinking that they would be interested in it. But I was wrong. They turned me into headquarters and said the only way that I could have written that article was that I had access to classified information. Therefore, I had breached the protocol and committed an ethical violation. So I was investigated for writing the open source article on Hamas. And after 11 months, I was finally exonerated. And that happened in mid to late 2006. So that was the first indicator to me that something was going sideways, because Hamas had already been designated as a global terrorist organization for several years. So why in the world would I get in trouble for writing an article that simply explained what the intentions of Hamas?
How important to the terrorist activities is the government of Saudi Arabia? I mean, we're touching on something that our government doesn't want to talk about, that tries to hide, has probably hidden it in documents and won't show us. And I believe they're in the 9/11 documents we can't see right now. How influential is Saudi Arabia with terrorism?
Well, the real force of gravity is vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia and the support of what becomes terrorism is its support of the vast system of madrasas, Islamic schools, primarily in what used to be known as the Indian subcontinent, meaning Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. They support thousands, if not tens of thousands, of madrasas where they send young men particularly to these schools and teach them basic Quranic theology and in the other texts of Islam. And these are the individuals who end up eventually going into groups like Taliban or Lashkar-e-Taiba or any number of other...
Or ISIS, would they do that too?
Or ISIS, yes. And for example, the word Taliban, which we hear a lot, that just simply means student. It's the plural of the word for student. Talib is singular. Taliban is plural. So what would you, the natural question you would ask if you tell somebody you're a student is, what do you study? Well, the Taliban are a branch of an Asian group of Islam called Deobandi. And they are very similar in ideology and theology to the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia. This started in about the 1860s, and they found they had common ground from their perspective, ideologically, theologically, and the relationship between Saudi Arabia and this vast network of madrasas.
Philip, hold on for a sec. We're going to hit the break. I'll be back with you and Art in just a second. Philip Haney, Art Moore, See Something, Say Nothing. As we get into this, you're going to hear things that will just rivet you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We are with Philip Haney and Art Moore. We're talking about the work See Something, Say Nothing about Homeland Security and their handling of many of the episodes you already know about. Philip, let's get back into the Saudi connection with some of this. Is it in your opinion that administrations, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, they really have a hands-off policy when it comes to Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's obviously a complicated situation, but the indicator of it is those still mysterious 28 pages. If things are so open and plain, then why don't they release that information? And that's just the one indicator of it. But going back to a broader-based historical foundation with the madrasa system that I mentioned earlier, that is really the source, the gravitational source of a lot of the militancy, radicalism, terrorism that you see in the world today, is the fundamentalist ideology that's being promoted to these generation after generation of young men in particular, who then grow up with this motivation to go out and accomplish something, to do something for the cause of Islam. And this has been going on for several generations now. We're starting to see the fruit of it. Bangladesh, Pakistan, India have hundreds of different subgroups, jihadist groups. Bangladesh itself has 90 different named groups.
Jeez.
Pakistan, not many less. So that is a lot of it right there, just very seldom ever addressed. And then you have the whole ideology that Osama bin Laden was promoting, who didn't think that the Saudi government was strict enough in its interpretation of Islam, simply because they didn't fully implement Sharia law, which brings us back to the real source of the chaos and violence that we see in the world today, is the effort to promote and implement Sharia law. And it's very important to understand that that's the reason for jihad. It's not random acts of violence that are disconnected here, there, and everywhere on the face of the earth. There's an underlying gravitational force, a compulsion to promote the implementation of Sharia law everywhere in the earth. And on that particular point, every single group in the world agrees. That is their common strategy. Mm-hmm. And they don't argue. What they argue about is tactics, how to go about it.
How to do it, and how to do it. And Art, let me bring you in here for a second and ask the question that a lot of Americans think about, and that is, there is no doubt that the policies of our country, of engagement, of occupation, have helped contribute to this as well. You will see that the countries that have been hit with terrorism are the ones that have been involved with us in the Iraqi conflict and issues like that. If we had taken the position of just not getting involved, would this still occur, Art?
I think it would. And I think while it's true that when you hear the declarations of people, when we heard Osama bin Laden, even before 9/11, make invitation to our country to turn to Islam. And in that, he listed the fact that we had troops on Saudi soil in the land of the two sacred cities. You do hear that rhetoric. But at the same time, you have to understand that these are people who we would describe as pietistic believers. They really believe that their God compels them to spread Islam throughout the world and to take hold of of every nation on Earth. And so you could actually find documents. This is the interesting thing, and I think we'll get into this more, is that there was this seminal trial that took place 2007-2008, the Holy Land Foundation trial that took place in Texas. The FBI presented evidence of that trial. This was the Justice Department prosecuting an Islamic charity that had eventually they discovered sent something like $12 million in material aid to Hamas. And at the trial, evidence was presented that uncovered what the Muslim Brotherhood is doing here in our country. And they see it as a 100-year plan to eventually, by infiltrating Western civilization from within, to bring the Western world under the umbrella of Islam, and eventually, as Philip is describing, to bring it into conformity with Islamic law.
Now, there's no question, though, that had we not infiltrated Iraq and deposed Saddam Hussein, or Libya, and gotten rid of Gaddafi, two leaders who were not Boy Scouts by any means, but they at least, you know, contained things. All of this has happened after those episodes. Can we blame that for this?
No, I think there's truth in what you're saying. I think, in fact, the Libya problem, I think, is a function of, and this was the Hillary Clinton State Department, which is relevant. We're talking about an election right now. But it was a miscalculation on her part. In fact, she supported this Muslim Brotherhood-led Libyan Transitional National Council that was revolting against Gaddafi. And as we know, Gaddafi was killed, and this Libyan National Council took over. And now what do we see? We see that groups related to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, have taken over large portions of Libya. And we ended up actually supplying, as far as we understand, there's evidence that we actually gave material support to these groups, that is guns, weapons, to these groups related to Al-Qaeda and perhaps even ISIS. And that's not to mention, we all know about the horrific loss of our ambassador and three other loyal Americans serving our country on September 11, 2012 in Benghazi.
Philip, you had advance notice because of your work of the Boston Marathon bombing. You were ahead of the game when the San Bernardino massacre occurred, yet nobody listened to you. Why not?
Well, I found out why not through probably an unconscious disclosure by an imam of the Islamic Society of Boston. Sometime after the bombing, he was interviewed by one of the local papers, and he made an intriguing declaration. He said that if the Islamic Society of Boston was really a radical mosque, that it would not have been engaging in outreach and dialogue with different branches of the federal government. I think he named perhaps DHS, Department of Homeland Security, FBI, State Department, and so on. And that's when I realized, no wonder they're not investigating the Islamic Society of Boston, which I knew from my perspective as a subject matter expert and counterintelligence specialist, had at least 40 individuals affiliated with it with what we call derogatory information, not to mention its affiliated organizations, all the way up to Al-Qaeda and Hamas and fundraising for terrorism. No wonder the government wasn't investigating. They were having outreach and dialogue with the very same organization. And that wasn't even all of it. They chose the community in Boston as what they call the model community, along with Minneapolis and with Los Angeles in 2014 and 2015, to roll out the Countering Violent Extremism program. Yet those very same leaders of those very same model communities publicly renounced the program, the one they helped start, saying that it was stigmatizing, ineffective, and discriminatory. So it's an incredible overlap or disconnect between what the government was attempting to do with organizations and individuals with known derogatory information. It was a colossal failure because these very same leaders of these very same communities publicly renounced the program. But going back to the original point is I realized that's why no one was listening, because they were conducting outreach and dialogue campaigns with these very same organizations.
Where did these groups get their money?
Well, a lot of it comes from what is called zakat, or what we would call charity or tithing in a Christian sense. According to Sharia law, there's a designated amount of your income that you're supposed to contribute everywhere, every year. And also, according to Sharia law, 1/8 of that designated money every year goes specifically to the support of the mujahideen, the fighters in the jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the most ominous things about Sharia law, that when you implement or when you allow the contribution of charity within the Islamic system, you are automatically supporting jihad. And so that is one source. The other source is foreign countries, like Saudi Arabia, who supports CARE, for example. They own the deed of the offices in Washington, D.C. And there are numerous different applications and examples of the involvement of foreign money in American-based Islamic organizations. But it's, from their perspective, it's one large pool of money, like a global organization. And the money is distributed as they see wherever it is needed, because there are no boundaries in the world, in Islamic worldview. There are no borders. That is what the caliphate is all about. We hear about the caliphate from ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but the caliphate is a more universal concept than even ISIS. And it's basically a shared common identity throughout the entire world. And what if my brother on the other side of the world needs help, then I will find a way to help them.
Well, and also it doesn't take a rocket scientist, Philip and Art, to ascertain that countries like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, the Emirates, specifically in Dubai, for example, are not hit with terrorism. And one has to ask yourself, why? Why aren't those areas being hit by terrorism? They all support the American way of living. I can only conclude that they're being paid off. These countries are paying off the terrorists.
The other problem is the definition of terrorism. We're using the same word for two entirely different worldviews. What they define as terrorism is not the same thing as what we define as terrorism. They don't necessarily see Hamas, for example, as a terrorist organization. They see them as a liberation organization,
right,
on the front lines against Israel. We, of course, define them as a terrorist organization. But what Hamas is doing is not un-Islamic. It's not a violation of Quranic principles.
But am I right about these countries that don't seem to have any terrorism there at all? I mean, Dubai continues, it's as Arabic as they come, and they continue to have wealth, and they're building skyscrapers bigger than, the Tower of Babel. They must be buying them off. What's that?
Yes, and I say what they do is they support it outside of their country.
Right.
In attempting to fend it off. But
they make it known to these recipients, these terror groups, that the money's coming from them, leave us alone. I got to believe that.
Yeah, it's a quid pro quo arrangement. You help us, we'll help you. You leave us alone, we'll help you promote Islam in other parts of the world. And as long as we keep that arrangement, then everybody will be happy.
Even though they're dealing with us too. It's bizarre.
Yeah, well, because when we get down to the bottom level, the ultimate simple, it's actually quite simple. It's not really that complicated. The goal of Islam is to promote Sharia law or implement Sharia law everywhere in the earth. Any opposition to that implementation is, there's a Quranic word for it, it's called fitna. It means opposition or resistance to. And that includes America. The fact that we are resisting the Islam, the implementation of Sharia law has a term in our language. Islamophobia. We're called Islamophobes because we resist the implementation of Islam. Well, in Arabic, that word is fitna. And when fitna exists, according to the Quran, there are options to address it, all the way up to and including violence. It can include persuasion. You know, you can just become a Muslim. But it also can include violence, where we actually physically attack you because you are resisting the promotion of Islam. And if you look at it from a Quranic perspective, it's actually not that difficult to understand. It's like a tide. That's why I called my earlier article Green Tide Rising, because it's exactly what it is. It's a rising tide.
Well, but why aren't these jihadists attacking Russia and China and other countries like that?
But they are. Western China, the Uyghurs, there is a lot of low-level attacks in Western China that just don't get in the news. Same with provinces of Russia, Chechnya, Ossetia, Dagestan. They are called the wolves of jihad. They are actually some of the most violent jihadis in the entire world.
Can this be beaten, Philip? Can we win this war?
Well, the first thing that we're going to need to do, if we ever have any hope of addressing it, is to honestly discuss what Islam really teaches. As long as we entertain ourselves, if you will, with the false narrative, we're never going to come to the place where we can honestly develop a counter-strategy or counter-tactical approach to it. It begins with understanding and facing what Islam actually teaches. What is the global strategy of the Islamic movement? Implement Sharia law. So here in the United States, one of the first ways to address that is to recognize that Sharia law is incompatible with the U.S. Constitution. And there is a movement across the United States to do that. But as you probably know, if you've been following the issue, every single state that tries to do it encounters fierce opposition.
Sure.
They are labeled as bigots and Islamophobes.
Right.
For what? For trying to establish or reestablish the authority of the U.S. Constitution, in particular Article 6. Not the First Amendment, no, Article 6 of the Constitution, which plainly states that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Therefore, any other form of law that seeks to usurp the authority of the Constitution is illegal.
All right, we're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and chat more with Art Moore and Philip Haney. See Something, Say Nothing. And we'll get you involved as well with your questions next.